Accession number 23364, reel 2.
And then we were doing foot patrols and truck patrols to Jericho. It's very hot down there. And then the battalion was split up by companies on different duties. One company would be in Hebron area, another company would be in the Gaza area, another company would be at home in Jerusalem, doing foot patrols and that, trying to keep the peace from the Arabs. And the patrols in the hills against it was always against the Arabs. We'd come across roadblocks of watermelons. Roadblock of watermelons. Dozens of them. 6 feet high, 6 feet broad, right across the road. But we didn't find it first. Another regiment found it first, and they were mined. When they tried to take it down, the mine went off. But we had an officer at that time who was had a reputation of being mad. Eventually Colonel Brodie.
Alec
Brodie. I was on the Jericho patrol one night and we come to this roadblock of watermelons and every vegetable, and of course I got off the truck, so there was no lights on the truck. And then Lieutenant Brodie at that time went forward. He was always known to be hairy. Started shifting the watermelons. And a sergeant said to him, "What are you doing, sir?" He said, "I'm looking for this so-and-so mine." He said, "It'll blow up, sir." He said, "Oh no, we'll get it out." So eventually, he came out with it in his hand. And of course, all the jocks dived in the ditch, the monsoon ditch. He says, "Oh, it's safe or not." Did that, and up she went. You see? And that's the sort of things he did.
Oh, yes. I knew him well.
Oh. I could tell you anything. I was attached with him in Malaya, to Sea Force in Malaya, in the jungle. He did some mad things then, honestly. But one thing I must tell you before I forget it. He said to me one day Kuantan, in Malaya. We were in a schoolhouse. He says, I was company sergeant major. He says, "Sergeant major, have we got any glory or glue?" I says, "Yes, sir, we got the white stuff." He says, "Well, could I have that?" And he's sitting at his desk, which was the headmaster's desk. So he says, "I've got a sticky, twisted mouth." He says, "I want to stick something." So when I gave it him, he says, "Oh, that's it." He pulled the drawer open, took all the papers out, put them in, and tipped the glue in the drawer. Out of the bottle, he says, "Yeah, you can have that." And he dipped his finger in the drawer. And I said, "I can't use that now, sir." He said, "Oh, it's all right, leave it." That was it. But that's the things he did.
Mm. Huh? Now, going back on a date time, this was then in 1940.
This would be 19. Let me see now. We went from there to the Sea Force. No, when I went to the Sea Force, was after the 2nd Battalion broke up. No, that would be 1948. But that was just something that he did.
Oh yes. No, I was trying to get back to the narrative.
No.
Of your original visit to Palestine.
2nd Battalion. There's not much there then until we got word that we were getting moved. We're going to be moved. Now, where was I? I was in Palestine, and there we did Gaza. We did the patrol. We did then the Jews started giving trouble. And the Arabs quietened down. And we used to go into Jerusalem and get situated on the top of these flat roofs overlooking the population. And I remember an incident there, and it's lived with me ever since. I said to a sergeant, I was a sergeant at the time, I said, there's something peculiar about all these people coming out of this factory, and I can't place it. He said, something peculiar. He says, yes, sergeant. He says, they've all got black hair. That was the Chinese population. Mm. They all got black hair, and it was just a black mass as you looked down. And I thought, this is funny, something funny here. There was no redheads or blondes or anything. All black. I still remember that. Mm. Yeah, one of those things that sticks in your mind at the time. Anyway, we started the patrolling in Jerusalem. And we were meeting bombs. Places blowing up. Trucks blowing up. Which we'd also met with the Arabs, trucks blowing up. Our first casualty in Palestine on a truck blowing up was a chap named Hood. But before I go any further, we had our first casualties in Jerusalem in the first week we were there. A chap named Hutchin and Milton was shot in the back. Outside, I think it was the Jaffa Gate or one of the gates in the old city. And I was on the patrol that went down to relieve it. And we found them lying face down, and both of them had their hand back on the bayonet, as though they had tried to draw the bayonet before they died. And they were shot in the back, completely. Now, that's the thing I don't want to say too much about, because that could have been the turning point in the history of the regiment. Because the battalion went haywire. Went haywire. And the one man that saved it was RSM Finlay. He should have been decorated, but he couldn't be decorated. Because if they'd have said why he got decorated, that would have come out. And we didn't want it. So I won't mention what happened. But it could have bust the battalion, the regiment. The men just went haywire when the two bodies were brought into barracks. Yeah. Yeah.
Where were you when you had the battalion had official news that war was about to break out?
Let me think.
You were still in Palestine.
Yes, you're in Palestine. No, we're in the Suez Canal.
You're down in the Suez in September 1939.
Patrolling the Suez Canal on the Bitter Lakes.
Yes.
Shadowing the Italian troop ships.
Yes, going. 1939.
That's when we heard we were going.
Yeah.
But we went to Aden first. Mm-hmm. And we heard that Aden was a punishment station at one time. And no wonder. There was no fans. The billets had an air gap at the top of the wall, between the wall and the roof, with small pillars. And monkeys just roamed through the place, small monkeys. As I say, there was no fans. I could see why it was a punishment station. And there was a pool of water for swimming in, but twice a day it used to be covered with volcanic dust. And if you went swimming in it, you had to get a shower after to clean yourself. And we knew we were standing by for British Somaliland to cover the withdrawal of the colonial troops. By this time I was a sergeant, or a lance sergeant at that time. No, I was a sergeant, yeah. And we heard we were standing by to cover the withdrawal of the colonial troops from British Somaliland. So we started training. Very hard. We'd already trained in Sarafand. I'd only got the carriers when I went to Sarafand. I was carrier sergeant. We'd done no training previously, only in trucks. So we were training. I'm going to see. That's an ailment I have, sneezing. So we started training in Aden. Then suddenly we were whipped onto ships and we reported disembarked at a place called Berbera in British Somaliland. And I had, I think, 11 carriers at that time. And we started moving what we call then up country by road. The population in Berbera didn't care for the British much. We couldn't get anything without a fight. So I had the carriers. I was carrier sergeant. I forget who my officer was. I think it was Mr. Snowden. I'm not sure. He got killed. So I said to one of my men, who was a rogue, but a good soldier, I said, come with me, hey, Timothy. I said, I'm going down to the ordnance depot in Berbera. I want spares for the carriers. I've got none. So he came down with me. And the reason I took him, he was a top soldier. He feared no one. He'd have killed his own granny. He was a professional. So I went into this store, this big store, and there was a sergeant there. And I told him what I wanted. He said, have you got your indent? I said, no, we've only just landed. I said, but I didn't know there was a store here. You see? I think my officer had taken ill or something, and he came in later. So he says, well, look, Sergeant, he says, you'll have to put it in triplicate. And you'll get it in 3 or 4 days. I says, look, Jock, in 3 or 4 days you won't be here. We're covering the withdrawal. He wouldn't budge. So one of my instances in my career where I arrested a court-martial, I said to Hay, over the counter and get what you want. He was a chief mechanic. So he came back and he loaded his stuff. And this sergeant was going to report me to the provost corporal and the brigadier and everything. I said, you do that. I said, but I may not be here when you come back. See, so we took all this stuff away and just give it out to the drivers and gunners and everything. And we went up country. And we stopped for the first night in jungle area, this jungle bush. And, of course, trained by then, we put pickets out at night. And there was again a plague of insects and snakes and what. And this time we were living on army biscuits. You know, you make porridge with it and everything. So we managed to get everything in, and we got up to position, and I think it was Colonel Rusk or Colonel Rose, one of the two.
Colonel Rose,
didn't he? He was in charge of this where we were, and showed our defences, you see. And it was just bush, this jungle bush. No trees, just bushes. on the Maidan. So I put the carriers in position. Can't remember an officer there. No, anyway. And the first thing we knew, through binoculars, could see the trucks coming, the Italian trucks coming, and unloading and spreading out over the Maidan towards us. So we got all the guns in position and everything. And then when it started, there was sniping. And one or two my men got hit. The next thing on came along was a chap named McGibbon, who finished a company sergeant major. He got the DCM. He came to me and he says, "Harry, have you got any spare grenades?" I said, "Aye, I've got grenades, plenty of them." I said, "Plenty in the carriers." He says, "Then let me have half a dozen." I says, "What are you on, Terry?" He said, "I'm going to quiet one or two of these snipers. They're a damn nuisance." Now, Terry McGibbon was an old farmhand type, a farmer. He's a real farmer type. So away he went. That one stopped. That one stopped. And that one stopped in a period of an hour. So Terry, next thing was Terry McGibbon. He said, "Thanks, Harry, that's quieting that one." He got the DCM. Well, we held back the first attack on the ground, and the man that I took over from on the carriers was a Sergeant George Sandy, who had been promoted on the new appointments of PSM, Platoon Sergeant Major, and he was in charge of the Pioneer Platoon, who had a sort of buffer gun on, or something like that. And he was on my left. And I took over from the carriers from him. But anyway, during the day, we ran out of water. It was very hot, very hot. Then I walked round before the attack came and found some of my men opening tins of apple juice and all and drinking it. And I stopped it. In fact, I dumped the tins. I said, "You're all right now, but that'll make you worse. Pear juice and plum juice." So I stopped that and I emptied the tins I could find. So then when the attack came, we beat it off. I had one sign of one soldier showing a little cowardice, but we cured that pretty quick. And then the next thing, George Sandy, PSN, came to me. He says, "Sergeant Wharton, warn your men to pack up. We're pulling out. We're making back to Berbera." He says, "When you see the very light go up, start your proceeding." So I warned my men. Then the light went up, and we started concentrating on the road with the carriers. So we didn't get any shots at us when we were coming out, but I had my driver, my carrier, got badly wounded, so I took over the carrier driving, and I had 14 men on it by the time I reached Berber. I'd picked up on the way officers, sergeant, NCO men. And there's two big wadis we had to cross. The bridges had been blown up. A lot of rocks.
But they were dry wadis?
Hmm?
They were dry?
Yeah. The wadis were dry and everything. So anyway, I put the carrier down and bumped and everything, praying to God that the tracks wouldn't bust on the rocks. Anyway, we got up the other side and started going on the level again. and the gearbox and differential started squealing. So I stopped, got out, looked out, and the cap was knocked off the gearbox. And the sump, oil all over the place. But this time we're only a few miles from Berbera. So I said to the men on the carrier, I said, we'll keep going until this machine stops. Mm-hmm. Then you'll have to walk. Mm-hmm. So we arrived at Berbera. And it was squealing, the gearbox. Mm. So when the men got off, we just drove it straight into the sea, off the promenade, whatever it was. And a chap there, I think he was an RTO, British chap, he said, I think you're unlucky. He said, that's the last ship out there. It's the Hobart, an Australian boat. He says, we'll have to evacuate this place in a couple of hours. He said, I don't know how you're going to get out to that boat. He said, there's only local rowing boats and everything. And he said, there's good news for you. He said, there's sharks in the water. I said, thank you very much. So, anyway, I commandeered a local boat. And I said to some of my drivers and that, I said, can you row? He said, never done it, Sarge, but we'll try it. You see, so we got to Hobart.
How many?
Eh?
How many?
All but three. And I didn't know till later, but the one thing I always remember, when we got on board the Australian, I think it was the Hobart. Yeah.
Could have been.
Anyway, it was an Australian cruiser or destroyer. White bread, which they bake on board, and butter. That's all the jocks were interested in. It tasted like sugar. And they scuff loaf after loaf after loaf on board, you see. And the sailors just fed it to them. And then slept. That's all they did. Until they took us back to Aden. Was it Aden? Yeah. Took us back to Aden. Got sorted out, re-equipped, and then back to Egypt. Then we were in Egypt at the Citadel.
What year?
Hey?
Where, give me the year.
Yeah. Citadel, 41, 40, round about 40, 41.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we heard we were getting re-equipped. We were getting re-equipped, and we weren't sure where we were going. But the General Wavell was to visit us in the Citadel, and we got a big draft out from England, from Scotland. And I was guard commander at the Citadel, main gate. There's a wall right around the Citadel.
Yeah.
And the adjutant, I forget who the adjutant was now, he phoned up. He said, Sergeant Walton, let me know as soon as the general arrived. He was General Wavell then, he wasn't Field Marshal. So I posted a soldier away down the road to take his hat off when the convoy was coming up. So the guard turned out. Now, I'd met General Wavell before in Perth at the depot. Anyway, so the chap took his hat off and did that. So the guard, stand by. Guard turned out. No, I could see now, and I look back, where Wavell got all his information and his books, and why he was such a good general. He says, oh yes, he says, you got any prisoners, Sergeant? I said, yes, sir, three. He says, could I speak to him privately? I said, oh yes, anyway. So I look through the peephole, and he's sitting on a bed, talking to the prisoners. I found out after he'd asked them if they were in Somaliland and all that, you see. So, while he was doing that, I phoned up the adjutant, who's up in the citadel. I said, he's in the guard room at present, sir. I said, in fact, he's just leaving now. I remember that, because when I was on the phone, he started coming out. So I put the phone down. So away he went. About 5 minutes after the phone went, it was the adjutant. He said, I thought you said the general was left the guard room. I said, he has, sir. I don't know where he is. He said, well, he's not here. He said, so I thought, what's up? Just too bad. I don't know where he is. So anyway, he phoned up again. He says, you don't know where the general went. I said, he didn't go out, sir. He went in. He eventually found him in one of the barrack rooms, sitting on a bed, talking to a group of soldiers. Did you know who was on your left? Did you know who was on your right? What was your rations like? And this is what he was asking him. And this is where he got his knowledge.
Yeah.
His adjutant was outside, sitting on the bench. He was inside with the jocks, sitting on the beds, talking to him.
Yeah.
That's where he got it. And so eventually the adjutant, he must have been in an office state, because he didn't know where the general was. He must have had his scouts out looking for, and they found him there. And so the adjutant apologised to me later on in the day or two that he gave me a twisting because I didn't know where he was. So I said, oh, that's all right, sir. So that was experience at the Citadel, and we got a very big draft there from the UK. Reinforcements brought us up to strength, and I think we went to Crete.
You went to Crete direct from Egypt?
From Egypt?
Yeah.
That's right. We went to Crete, and when we were going to Crete, we were in convoy from Alex in Egypt. And as we approached Crete, Italian planes, or German planes, I forget now, came over the crest of the mountains and started shooting up the ships as we were coming in. And I remember the troops going to one side of the ship and the skipper saying over the tannoy, get away from the side of the ship, she'll go over. All the troops had gone on one side and she was over. Of course, when the machine gun, they got the other side quick. And we were heavily, they give us a hammering going into Crete and Suda Bay. And as we got into Suda Bay, there was ships, funnels and masts and wirelesses sticking out of the water, all in the harbour. And we couldn't make out just where we were going, on Crete. So they said, oh, this is Suda Bay. I asked a sailor, he said, it's Suda Bay. We went, they dropped, no. The battalion dropped off at Suda Bay, and the carriers went on up to Malan, forget the name now. Malani, something like that, was another airport in Crete. And we went up there, only up there a few days, and by this time my officer was an officer called Lieutenant Snowden. Very nice chap. A young chap, very young. And he took command of the carriers. And I think it was the second morning or third morning we were up there. He says, "We're moving tomorrow morning by road down to Heraklion."